Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The Committee on Energy, Utilities, Environment, and Climate will come to order. It's Monday, March 18th at 12:40 p.m. We're in room 1150 of the Minnesota Senate Building. A quorum is present. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Apologize for the delay. I'm coming from the Jobs Committee, and we will start by presenting. Senate File 4943. I'm going to pass the gavel down to Senator Zhang.
Senator Friends, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I'm proud to present Senate File 4943. This is the Department of Commerce provisions and technical and housekeeping modifications. Mr. Chair, I'm asking you to allow Mr. Kelly to testify from the department.
All right, Mr. Kelly, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. As Chair Friends mentioned, Senate File 4943 is a technical cleanup bill to 216C. Currently in 216C, for sections 2.08 through 0.10, these outline commissioner jurisdiction, duties, and powers, and the bounds are only from 216C05 to 30. That being said, there are many more programs than just through Section 30 that are in 216C where the commissioner has authority over the programs, and we're just making clear that the authority is for the entire chapter, and then for any future programs that are added, rather than limiting it to a number, we are just making clear that it has it for the chapter. Every program that's listed in 216C, the commissioner is named in it. We're just making it clear. As we understand it, this is as far as the chapter went at that point in time, and so we just want to make it clear. And this is really important for our enforcement folks to be able to take swift action if we need to, if there's a contractor or if there's any kind of fraud. While we have broad authority in Chapter 45 and we think we have the authority here in 216C, we just want to make it clear. If there's a fraud, we want to be able to act swiftly because time is of the essence. And that is the bill.
All right. Senator Friends, you have anything else to add?
No.
No? Members of the committee to the bill? With that,
Mr. Chair, anything else, we Senator lay Friends? This bill
we're going to, with that, we will lay over the bill. Senator McEwen, your bill will be up next as we get ready for the next bill. And we're going to hand the gavel back to Senator Friends.
Members, we're now going to hear Senator McEwen, Senate File 4742. Senator McEwen, welcome to your committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. As you know, the state of Minnesota is making significant investments to fund broadband deployment. And we, as a state, are about to receive a substantial one-time infusion from the federal government to help assure all Minnesota homes and businesses have access to high-speed broadband in all corners of the state. It is, therefore, critically important that we get this right. We need to ensure not only that we are investing in high-quality, reliable broadband infrastructure, but that the work is done safely and in a manner that develops the skilled workforce that will continue building, maintaining, upgrading, and replacing broadband infrastructure for decades to come. Senate File 4742 establishes guardrails to ensure that broadband is not being deployed at the expense of worker safety, public safety, or in ways that compromise critical electric, gas, water, and telecommunications infrastructure. This bill raises quality and safety standards, enhances training, reduces turnover, and ensures that our investments in broadband deliver middle-class jobs. It also leverages state and federal investments to support development of a skilled workforce and creation of family-supporting careers for Minnesotans. The bill does this by awarding a portion of state and federal broadband development grants to applicants who promote workforce development best practices, including provision of skills training and family-supporting wages and benefits. Applicants for the grants can demonstrate this by either paying the prevailing wage rates currently required for deployment of middle-mile broadband, or two, by providing employer-funded training, family health coverage, and retirement benefits. This bill would not prevent any applicant from seeking funding, and it's important to make sure that people understand that, regardless of whether the applicant implements workforce best practices or not, as long as the applicant complies with federal law. Senate File 4742 also establishes a basic safety training standard for the installation of broadband, similar to what exists today for pipe laying in Minnesota. And it also holds bad actors accountable for damage to critical underground utility infrastructure when broadband is installed. This bill is consistent with National Telecommunications and Information Administration labor standards requirements and will strengthen the state's broadband funding application. Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers who will speak further to the bill.
Thank you very much, Senator. First on our list, I show Kevin Pranis from Wayuna. Mr. Pranis, if you can come forward, please. On deck would be Dan McConnell from the Building Trades Council. Mr. Pranis, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Frantz and committee members. Kevin Pranis on behalf of Liona, Minnesota, North Dakota. We represent 14,000 skilled construction laborers in the two states. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank the author for bringing this very important bill. So Liona, just to give a background on the bill, Liona spent the past year interviewing workers, contractors, utilities, and other stakeholders in broadband, really leading out of the Congress's and the President's historic investments in broadband infrastructure. We wanted to understand the nature of the business. And we found hard workers who took their jobs seriously, some with years of experience in the field. We also found responsible contractors who take quality and safety seriously. But what we found at the same time was that experienced workers were the exception, that the workers that we talked to were underpaid, extremely stressed, had no training virtually at all, except for whatever limited on-the-job experience they had. And the typical worker we spoke to had less than 2 years of experience, while many had less than a year, some in supervisory positions or operating equipment with minimal experience. And it wasn't surprising given the levels of pay and benefit they receive, which is far lower than their peers doing very similar work for other utilities. We also heard from contractors, union and non-union, who talked about the competitive pressures that they faced in the industry, the growing presence of out-of-state contractors who underbid them, and what they saw as deteriorating standards directly tied to the amount of additional money that was flowing into this industry, which was making it difficult for them to be able to succeed and compete. The best example of what we found was workers in Minneapolis who had been instructed to begin doing directional drilling through the street where there was a gas line marked, and they didn't know where the gas line was at what depth, but they had been instructed to begin drilling anyway. And because they were afraid of what might happen, that they might hit the gas line, they were waiting for their foreman to show up. But there was no requirement that they should, as state law requires, actually visibly see that line before crossing it. And so that's why, that was the motivation for this bill. We want to thank the Minnesota Rural Electric Association and DEED's Office of Broadband Development for very productive dialogue that is ongoing to figure out the best way to solve these problems with the least impact. I want to talk briefly about what this bill does and doesn't do. What it does do is take a flexible and surgical approach to the problems. We worked very hard not to sort of use a broad brush and not to sort of like over-regulate or negatively impact the program to ensure qualified workforce, incentivize best practices, and provide accountability, which this committee may want to discuss, about making sure that broadband providers are not abusing the sort of regulated utility system. What this bill does not do, it will not prevent our state from receiving any federal funding. Quite the opposite, the Biden administration has been very clear that these are exactly the sorts of things that they want to see in applications. It will not require payment of prevailing wage to broadband workers, which, while we support prevailing wage, our bill does not ask for a requirement for prevailing wage. I think even though it's required for any other public subsidy of construction. And it does not require broadband providers to participate in the program. They can opt under our structure that we proposed. People could continue business as usual and continue to make applications and receive funding for the program with an incentive for high road practices. And it certainly does not require contractors to be union or workers to be union. The last point I want to make is the third section, which is why I believe we're referred to Energy Committee, involves the Public Utility Commission, and this is a simple authorization for the Commission to protect regulated infrastructure, which is being hit hundreds of times a year by directional drilling for telecom companies, and to make sure that if there are providers that are not using best contracting practices and repeatedly damming public utilities, that those dangers are addressed and that the safety of the current system as well as the reliability of the system is protected by the Commission, which has extensive experience doing investigations, finding fact, and figuring out how to assess the proper response. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pranis. Our next testifier is Mr. McConnell. Mr. McConnell, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, friends, Vice Chair Zhang, and committee members. My name is Dan McConnell, and I have the honor of serving as the president of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. The Minnesota Building Trades and our affiliated unions represent more than 70,000 skilled construction workers who build our state's infrastructure. I'm here today to support Senate File 4742. Access to reliable high-speed internet is a necessity for our members and their families and for all Minnesotans. Broadband is a critical infrastructure. Yet today, broadband installation is not held to the same high standards that we apply to every other area of infrastructure construction. Minnesota's public infrastructure is built and maintained with prevailing wage protections that prevent a race to the bottom and encourage contractors to invest in a skilled workforce. Meanwhile, our privately owned gas and electric infrastructure is built and maintained by equally skilled workers under the oversight of the Public Utilities Commission. Cable and broadband are the exception to these. Despite the fact that the industry receives hundreds of millions of dollars in public funding, workers lack prevailing wage protections, resulting in a race to the bottom. And despite the fact that telecom installers damage underground utilities on an almost daily basis, there's no minimum training requirements or oversight mechanisms to hold bad actors accountable. The North America's Building Trades Unions were proud to support the historic investments in broadband infrastructure as part of the bipartisan infrastructure law. But if we don't act now to create basic standards and oversight, the additional dollars will make this serious problem worse. The broadband industry already faces a critical shortage of skilled workers due to lack of training, high turnover, that are the natural consequences of low pay and high stress. While telecom lobbyists tout the industry training programs, the sad fact is that most of the workers interviewed have never heard of the programs or won't be around long enough to get any benefit from them. And while these lobbyists talk about industry safety record, what they don't tell you is their safety metrics don't include all the contractors and subcontractors working on broadband projects. Worse, their metrics don't include line strikes, which pose the greatest risk to public safety. As a licensed electrician in the state of Minnesota, I have extensive experience doing trenching and underground utility work. I have seen firsthand how quickly the simple trenching job that you've been told is clear of any utilities can result in catastrophic damage to underground facilities. Damage at the least can result in an isolated surface disruption, or at the worst can interrupt critical services to all Minnesotans and result in serious or fatal injuries to those working nearby. As a member of the Emily Cooperative Telephone Company, I would hope that all telecom providers would agree that standards are needed to protect their underground facilities and provide for greater worker safety. Senate File 4742 is a modest effort to set basic standards and put broadband on a path to the success Minnesota has had achieved in every other area, building safe infrastructure that Minnesotans can rely on while creating family-supporting jobs for local workers. Thank you for your time. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. McConnell, and to all the testifiers, if you could stay around for questions. Members, let's do the testifiers first and then go to member questions. Seeing no big objection, our next testifier is Brent Christensen from Minnesota Telecom Alliance. On deck would be Brian Krambeer from MyEnergy. Mr. Christensen, nice to see you again. Welcome back to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Happy to do so, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. MTA membership is a mix of cooperatives, family-owned, privately held, and publicly traded broadband providers throughout Minnesota. While MTA members have many different corporate structures, one thing we have in common is our commitment to serving Minnesota. Last year, my members invested just under $360 million in private capital, and this year they're planning to invest nearly $300 million to expand broadband throughout Minnesota. And I'm here today to testify in opposition of Senate File 4742. And my members oppose this bill for a variety of technical and policy reasons, but most importantly, because it does not comply with the Notice of Funding Opportunity issued by NTIA for Broadband Equity, Access, and Deployment, or BEAD. It also does not conform with the Volume 2 plan filed by the Office of Broadband Development last December. This legislation puts at risk the loss of nearly $652 million in federal BEAD dollars earmarked for Minnesota in two ways. First, it does not comply with the BEAD program and obligations. And second, I've polled my 41 rural broadband provider members, and none of them had said that they would have any intention applying for BEAD under these circumstances. One member, a union shop, told me that they meet many of the criteria included in this bill, and they still would not apply for BEAD. The reporting obligations and regulatory burden are too onerous and not worth the matching private investment. These are companies that have participated in the border-to-border broadband grant program since its inception. So what happens when the providers walk away and don't participate? Well, I can tell you, it won't get built. We will continue to serve our existing customers. We just won't expand to Minnesotans that don't have quality service today. And if it doesn't get built, then the state of Minnesota will default on its obligation to NTIA. It's not a threat, it's not a bluff, it's just simply reality. Mr. Chairman and members, I ask proponents of this bill to produce the data to support the claims, and frankly, I would be surprised if they would be able to do so. I am proud to say that MTA has operated a telecom-specific safety program for over 40 years. Previous testimonies disparaging our safety record are simply not true. MTA currently trains over 3,300 employees from 65 companies in six states. OSHA has established a specific mathematical calculations that enable any company to report recordable incident rates, lost time rates, and severity rates, so that they're comparable to across any industry or group. This is known as the OSHA incident rate. And we collect OSHA Form 300 reports from every company on every employee that we train. OSHA has determined that a good incident rating is 3.4. The lower the rating, the better your safety training is. Across our industry, we're at a 2. And that's far better than what OSHA expects. Finally, another reason that I can tell you that this bill is unnecessary is the fact that the legislature established a process long ago to address broadband deployment issues. For more than 15 years, the Governor's Broadband Task Force has worked to address issues relating to broadband deployment. Each year, the task force is required to file a report with recommendations to the Governor and legislature. This has worked well for 15 years, and this bill does an end run around the very process that this body put in place. Proponents of the bill know this. They even have two members that are on the committee, and still they did an end run around this. For the integrity of the process and the work of the all-volunteer task force, this matter should be sent back for the task force for study. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to stand for your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Please stay nearby for questions. We'll go now to Brian Krambeer, and on deck we would have Mark Muller. Mr. Krambeer, please identify yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Krambeer, and I am the president and CEO of My Energy Cooperative, headquartered in Rushford, Minnesota. I am also the chairman of My Broadband, our broadband partnership that includes My Energy Cooperative and two local telephone co-ops, Spring Grove Communications and Mabel Cooperative Telephone. We are undertaking a broadband initiative to extend fiber to the home to the unserved and underserved residents of southeastern Minnesota. I am here to share our concern regarding the proposed legislation on fair labor standards, particularly in relation to its impact on rural broadband development. For the last 6 years, our organization has been working diligently to deliver fiber communications to the rural areas of our electric co-op service territory. One of the main reasons that our area is unserved is because of the low density. Our electric co-op averages less than 4 members per mile of line, and we're seeing that same low density in our broadband build-out. Houston, Fillmore, and Winona counties are also low-earning counties in Minnesota. The terrain in southeastern Minnesota, while beautiful with the hills, valleys, and blufflands, adds to the challenge of extending broadband. What I have just described makes the economic landscape of our broadband initiative already very delicate. I have served 3 years on the Governor's Broadband Task Force. The Office of Broadband Development, OBD, and the Department of Employment and Economic Development have developed an excellent broadband program. Their guidance and funding mechanisms have set a national benchmark for efficient and effective broadband development initiatives. They have incredibly good leadership demonstrated by Bree Mackey in the Office of Broadband Development. I would ask you to allow them to continue their commendable broadband program. The proposed legislation, however, threatens these efforts by adding further financial burdens to projects that are already strained by permitting costs, engineering timelines, fiber material costs, and higher interest costs. It would jeopardize our ability to fulfill our commitment for broadband access in rural communities. In conclusion, I urge you to consider the impact of this legislation on our ongoing efforts to extend broadband to the rural areas of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share my comments here today, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Krambeer, and please stay around for questions afterwards. Next, we'll hear from Mark Muller, and on deck would be Jeffrey Carlson. Mr. Muller, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Mark Muller, CEO, President, Telecom Construction, Clearwater, Minnesota. Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to come here today. What I bring is 38 years of experience in the industry since the inception of the fiber itself programs from day one. Also in the development of directional drilling and other applications for the installation. Telecom Construction has been operating in the state of Minnesota for 24 years, and the communications industry is known as a leader with a full commitment to the industry. My leadership also includes multiple people with 35 to 42 years of experience each. And then the leadership industry knowledge, that's an important piece to this. Companies need to manage this work, they have to have the experience to manage it. When you look at the labor, it's instrumental, right? But it's only enforceable, and the safety practices are only led by companies with great leadership. What's needed for this industry, and we currently provide, is fiber to the home project management, turnkey projects in multiple states, builds from maintenance work to multi-million dollar project management, engineering and project design, experience management, experience operators, experienced laborers, experienced splicers, ability to work with all state municipals and governing agencies and permitting applications. When you speak safety, we take a very high standard of safety. Last year, we performed 112 contracts in the last 12 months. Dedicated safety staff doing daily site visits, and required for supervisors to do safety audits regularly. My company did nearly 4,000 safety audits, and they were completed in 2023. Almost 1 million work hours in 23 with only 5 recordable injuries. And remember, recordable injuries can be a prescription of ibuprofen. Recordable injury rates are well below industry standards, average of 1.02 for last year, and the OSHA requirement is at 3.4. Only one injury last year resulted in lost time. It has been 300 days since Telcom's lost workday injury and 763 days without a lost workday before that. Safety policies that go above and beyond OSHA standards in several areas high risk and ensure safe work practices and safety of employees. Trenching and shoring average depths in communications industry is 36 or less. OSHA standards are shoring boxes after 5. Our policy is 4. Communications we also require JTSAs, that stands for job task safety analysis, conducted daily by foremen with the entire crew on each job, built into our payroll and billing system so it cannot be skipped. Foremen get the whole crew together at the beginning of each day to review and document all hazards and how to mitigate them. Last year, we performed 26,722 jobs. Telcom's JTSAs is 30,180 performed. So there are some jobs where we go to multiple jobs in the same day. So we are doing a per job, per site. Our DOT scores, which is pertinent to the ability to operate in the national averages, vehicle is 22.26, Telcom's 11.8 with no fatal or injury crashes. Safety training. New hires train consistently of 5 days in classroom hands-on for training facilities on policy and procedures along with operational training conducting by dedicated safety training personnel. Not done, and also provide L10 and L30 OSHA requirements. Directional drilling, knowing how to be safe around the operator, operations and equipment. I have a training center that we put those employees through to make sure that they're safe and understand. Excavation equipment, we go through all excavation equipment that are required for it and also do training on safety and avoidance of any accidents. Utility avoidance program, locate tickets, tolerant zones. Telcom's policy that we find and expose all utilities before crossing to avoid a hazard or incident. Annual safety training on regulatory requirements and job-specific items conducted by safety personnel. Ongoing training through our LMS learning management system, weekly toolbox talk, safety stand downs is a big piece of that. Everybody understands that they have the authority to shut down any job at any given time for any safety reason. We also carry, as a company, proper liability, personal injury insurance, and the proper languages that go with those insurance certificates, which is a major piece of that. We have a career development program, employee education, dedicated field instructors. Training on equipment used in the communication industry are not trained by organized labor. Directional drilling, horizontal drilling, aerial construction, which in the metropolitan area is 40% of the work, and that is done aerial. And we have certifications to work in the power space with employees that would be introduced or be in that circumstance. That is not trained by the organized labor. Placement of the fiber cable itself.
Mr. Mueller, I appreciate that you're giving us the detail, and I think you're making an excellent point about the training. We need to move it along, so maybe wrap it up in a minute or two, please.
Yes.
Thank
you. Yes, sir. Placement of the fiber cable itself, jetting fiber, pulling fiber, placement, construction, communications, fiber handling, splicing equipment, splicing techniques, and splicing specs. Those programs are not available out from organized labor. Quality Control Department, which is an investment of the people and companies in Minnesota, including and all taxpayers. We self-regulate and installation of utility facilities in addition to the inspection that are on job sites at most all times during the process during the day. We check for proper depth, place per the permitting agencies, structures placed properly, all equipment and vehicle operated correctly daily. As far as we follow all federal, state, and county criminal search verifications, motor vehicle record, sex offender registry searches conducted, commitment to drug-free workplace, use of E-Verify in conjunction with Form I-9 completion, commitment to immigration laws extended to subcontractors, subscan process I-9, badge scan verification, individual has work authority and approved to be on site, independent 24/7 ethics reporting. Women, minority, disability-owned business partners, company committed to utilizing vendors, subcontractors, commitment to affirmative action related to employee and women, minorities, and individuals with disabilities. I'm expressly concerned in Minnesota communications companies and all of the employees and their families, and more specifically the families that work for me, of how the decisions made here today affect their lives and future as taxpayers. We are all tax-paying citizens, offer the best quality, efficiencies, safety, and performance value of all taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. We are who people think of and want when building fiber to the home projects in the country, the Midwest, and specifically Minnesota. We build Minnesota's future. I thank you for the opportunity, for having a voice for all of my employees and their families.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Next, we'll have Jeffrey Carlson. Mr. Carlson, could you please introduce yourself and present your testimony?
Thank you, Senator France. I am Jeff Carlson. I run a business out of Clearwater County, Minnesota. We do underground cable installation. We do active house wiring. We do fiber optic cable splicing. We do all the things that this bill affects. We've worked on about 14 different deed border-to-border grant projects, and my business is exclusively for independent telephone companies. I've been doing this for 46 years, and I think it's important to look at this bill and try to understand that the very first fiber optic communication between a home and a home was done in Minnesota. That's the first time it had ever been done in the world. It was done by the independent telephone companies. It was done by a small company called Optical Solutions, which is now Calix, one of the largest fiber-to-the-home companies in the nation, public. Our little company started in 1999. I started with myself splicing fiber. I currently employ anywhere from 70 to 95 people in the state of Minnesota, primarily all on broadband deployment. We work exclusively on fiber to the home. One thing I find really unique is I hear this bill and I hear how all the safety and all the things that everybody's saying that we don't do, yet the telecommunications system is the only one in the nation that's 99.9% reliable. That's a reliability standard that everybody talks about. And why Minnesota? Minnesota has inclement climate. Our broadband system, everybody wants to try it up here because of the inclement weather. But it's still a telecommunications or cable-based business. And I say that because they're the primary ones that do all of this work. And the contractors, there are more underground cable contractors in Minnesota that work exclusively on copper, fiber, cable, and broadband than any other state in the nation. And that says something. Most of those contractors are non-union. We do all have our own safety standards. And because it's federal, we have to comply with OSHA. One of the things that I think is critical to this bill is when you're laying pipeline or water or sewer, you are excavating in depths that exceed 5 feet or more. When we're doing telecommunications, we are very seldom excavating more than 4 feet of the earth. It's very hard to drastically hurt people, such as shoring and everything. I think the bill has a lot of things that could be done to it. In other words, if they worked and tried to actually build a broadband or telecommunications type safety program that deals with that. The reliability of the telecommunications industry, the cell phones, everything that goes is a testament to what the independent telephone companies have done here. Our safety program follows the MTA, and the reason for it is all of our customers are telephone, independent telephone companies. My company works in over 12 states, and I think it's critical that all 12 of them states say, what is the Minnesota model? They all follow what happens here, and it's very important that they do, because Minnesota is such a test bed. With that, I guess I would ask you to consider, and I think that with the MTA and all of the contractors that are here in Minnesota, everybody could work together to pass a bill that would protect all of the safety of the workers. It would also provide the benefits necessary. We provide all benefits, 401k, health insurance, the entire gamut. We now function with the ESST. We have to incorporate the FMLA into our business as well. We follow all OSHA safety guidelines, all federal DOT guidelines. We're not contractors out there like you're hearing about that just go put a directional drill in the ground and don't care where it goes. I've never heard of anything like that. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I think this bill could have some room, but I think it's got to be very directed at broadband. And I think you heard from others that, you know, the cost of feasibility is really the price of the alternative. And I think that's what we got to look at if we're going to deliver broadband throughout the state. I thank you for your time and everybody listening.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. If you'll stay around, we may have some member questions. We have one other witness, Tony Mendoza from the Minnesota Cable Association. Mr. Mendoza, if you could please come forward. Mr. Mendoza, welcome to the committee. If you could start, please, by introducing yourself and then presenting your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Tony Mendoza. I am outside counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I know you're short on time, so I'll keep my comments pretty high level. We also have a letter in the packet that gets into some of the more detail of our concerns. MCCA is concerned about the impact of SF 4742 and what it will do to the goal of achieving universal broadband for Minnesota. The state and the Biden administration have set aggressive goals for universal broadband and dedicated millions toward achieving those goals. The Biden administration is allocating $652 million to Minnesota through the BEAD program administered by NTIA. In designing BEAD, NTIA mandated that the Office of Broadband Development award grants, quote, in a manner that ensures the deployment of service to all unserved locations. NTIA provided OBD just 4 years to deploy $652 million to meet that mandate. The Minnesota legislature set a goal that by 2026, quote, all Minnesota businesses and homes have access to broadband at speeds of 100 over 20 megabits per second. This year, OBD celebrates its 10th anniversary. Over those 10 years, MCCA members have worked in strong partnership with OBD to create what's known nationally as the Minnesota model. Through that model, we've brought our state to the threshold of universal broadband. BEAD funding provides a once-in-a-generation opportunity to cross that threshold. OBD has already submitted its BEAD plan, which is currently under review by the NTIA. Recognizing the need for speed and to stretch BEAD funding as far as it can go to achieve the federal universal broadband mandate, Congress didn't apply the Davis-Bacon Act or any of the other regulations in the bill to BEAD. For the same reasons, the Minnesota legislature hasn't imposed prevailing wage regulations or regulations in this bill on state-funded last-mile broadband projects. This bill puts OBD in a catch-22. If prevailing wage and new regulations in this bill become law, the state will fail to meet its federal mandate and the state's 2026 goal. Whether you support the policies in the bill or not is beside the point. It's simply a question of math. Because MCCA believes it's important for Minnesota to meet the BEAD mandate and the state broadband goal, MCCA opposes this bill. If the committee decides to move forward with the prevailing wage and new regulations in this bill over achieving the state's universal broadband goals and mandates, and this bill moves forward, MCCA has questions about the bill that are, as I mentioned earlier, in a separate letter to the committee. We'll continue to work with stakeholders and the author on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mendoza, for your testimony. Members, before we go to questions, are there any members of the public who want to come forward and testify either in opposition or support to the bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. I see Senator Grunhagen, then Senator Matthews. We'll start with Senator Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I found the testimony very interesting by the last five individuals. And, you know, one of my questions that I had originally written down when I reviewed this bill was, what is a place we can look for an error rate by a particular business in the state of Minnesota? And one of the testifiers, I think it was Bruce Christensen, said the OSHA incident rate is set at 3.4, and their business is at 2.0. So to me, if you puncture a line or something like that, there's got to be some type of a record here at the state on that. And as long as these companies are under what is recommended by OSHA or whatever agency is in charge of that, to me they should be eligible to tap into this $652 million. So my question is, how can we, you know, there was disparaging, I'll use the word lightly, testimony about these other five testifiers who had concerns. So why are we not using those safety incidences from OSHA and probably other agencies as a measure of who's eligible for this $652 million grants for broadband? That's my question.
Thank you, Senator Grunhagen. Why don't we start with the bill author, Senator McEwen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the question, Senator Grunhagen. Real quick on the OSHA, well, actually, before I talk about the OSHA standard, the incident rate, I want to make sure that we're very crystal clear that there is no disparaging intended upon any of these excellent actors who are doing very good, high-quality work. And I also encourage everybody to read the bill, because some of the testimony we have heard today and in the past expresses some concerns that I don't think are necessarily warranted based on what the bill actually does and doesn't do. So the bill doesn't preclude, as I said in my opening remarks, the bill doesn't prevent any applicant from seeking this funding. It's still open. It merely provides that a certain portion of the funding will go to these businesses that employ these best practices, and they have a couple of different ways that they can demonstrate that. They don't have to be union shops. There's a lot of flexibility in this bill. But when we're talking about the OSHA incident rates, I think having that low OSHA recordable incident rate, it's very commendable. That's excellent. But the thing is that it does not address the high incidence of the line strikes by broadband installers, which is one of the main issues that this bill hopes to address. And it doesn't prove necessarily that the industry as a whole is operating safely. So OSHA incident rates don't capture damage to underground utilities unless workers are injured as a direct result of that. And they also fail to include injuries to workers employed by contractors or subcontractors. Also, OSHA rates can sometimes be unreliable when employees lack union representation and have protection from potential retaliation for reporting injuries. So the OSHA rating is excellent. I'm really glad that it's there. It is one measure. It's important. It's illustrative. But it's not the final word, and I think those concerns remain. And perhaps my testifier also has
another Thanks, question. Senator McEwen. Mr. Pranis, do you want to add anything there to Senator Gruenhagen's question?
Thank you, Chair Frantz. The author did an excellent job of explaining. I would just say that OSHA, I think OSHA ratings are an important piece of information, but they're minimally relevant to what we're really concerned about, which is hitting gas and electric lines, and those rarely result. Those don't show up on the OSHA incident rates.
Senator Gruenhagen, follow up.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that response. Yeah, and my question would be for Mr. Kevin Pranis. Out there, if you injure a line, don't you have to report that someplace? So isn't there another set with some agency that's reported to, if you follow my question?
Senator McEwen.
Well, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Gruenhagen. I'll go ahead and defer to Mr. Pranis.
Mr. Pranis.
Thank you, Chair and Senator Gruenhagen. So currently, telecom contractors are not actually required to report. Typically, the way those reports work is if the owner of the infrastructure is a gas or an electric regulated utility, they would pretty consistently report to the Office of Pipeline Safety. But if data lines are hit, there's no such requirement, and so we actually don't have great data on all that. There are sort of privately submitted. There's the Common Ground Alliance collects that information, and you can look that up. And so we can see, in fact, that the number one cause of line strikes is from directional drilling from telecommunications and cable contractors. That doesn't give you information on which companies are involved. That information is only presented in total and does not allow us to identify which companies are hitting lines more often.
Senator Gruenhagen, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for that response. And I guess I'd just like to hear from one of the five testifiers who had concerns about the bill in response to the answers that I've given here in terms of the pipeline safety, the infraction of the data. If either Brent Christensen, Mark Miller, we got somebody coming forward.
Senator Gruenhagen, Mr. Christensen's back at the testifier's table. Do you mind sort of restating your question?
Okay, I guess I'd like a response to what you just heard from Senator McEwen and also Mr. Pranis in terms of the safety of the pipeline and if you damage a data line. It sounded like there's no reporting on that.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Christensen, welcome back to the table. Any response you want to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gruenhagen. Actually, that's managed through the Gopher State One Call process. So if there's a strike or somebody doesn't follow that, then that is tracked by the Office of Pipeline Safety. I don't have any data to tell you how many of those strikes have come from my members. I don't hear about them. I mean, they would tell me if this was a big problem because we're the ones that put the infrastructure in. We're also the ones that have the infrastructure in the ground. So if this was happening as frequently as they have said, this would be a big problem in our industry, and it's not. As far as hitting pipelines and things, I can't tell you. I don't have any evidence to dispute what he's saying, but I don't have any evidence to affirm it either.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. comment. Christensen. Senator Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you for that response. And then, I guess that I would just say there's been a law on the books. We heard this in Labor Committee for 15 years that has governed this area. And in Labor Committee, we had testimony that it's worked very well, and there wasn't any dispute on that. And it seems like this bill, I'll give you the, football huddle. It seems like state should be a referee, but I think the referee is getting into the huddle calling the plays with this bill, okay? And I don't think the five that raised concerns are completely off, and I think I would appreciate if you would work with them to come to more peace in the valley so that, you know, it's $652 million of taxpayer money, some of which their members probably paid in, and I think we could have a little bit more peace in the valley so everybody gets an equal shot at applying for this money. That's the end of my testimony or questions.
Thank you, Senator Grunhagen. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if you would inform us first as to what the plan is for this bill moving forward.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. The motion is going to be to move it to agriculture. My intention is actually to ask Senator McEwen at the conclusion of member questions if she wants to consider laying it over. If the author were to ask for that, of course, we would do that. If the author asked for it to go to agriculture, I think we'll have to put it to a vote. But the motion, I think, is to move it to agriculture.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I don't see that the testimony for this bill fully held up to the scrutiny from the other testifiers that has come. I think that at a minimum, more work should be done on it. I'm also reading in here, I do think that this is going to have some pretty significant changes to what's accessible to our members around rural Minnesota if they don't meet all the things on this list, because we're going to limit the money in pretty significant ways outside of their grasp, starting with 50% just in this year in 2024. And then the numbers on page 2, lines 16 through 18, it escalates to 60% and then 70% in 2026. So this does have some pretty significant changes to it. We heard proponents that came and shared one perspective, and the ones with concerns that gave their viewpoint. And I think that there's still, we're definitely not seeing at the same level here with this bill. I think I question, you know, where some of these statements have been coming from as well. If we've got something, if we've got, you know, a pipeline safety issue, if that was a bigger concern and we need something targeted for that, then let's have a discussion that's targeting that. And we do have ways to help deal with, you know, the bad actor companies that are today. But it sounds like, I mean, sitting here listening to things made me sound like we were in an era from long ago before we had a lot of rigorous safety standards in a lot of industries, and we have the people that are actually helping put the work on the ground coming up and saying, what are you talking about? This is not the way we've operated our company now for a very long time. So I would urge the parties involved with this to try to work this out a little more, see if we can come to some better resolution. So I'd urge at least pushing the pause button here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Matthews. We're going to go to Senator Weber, and after Senator Weber, Senator Hoffman. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to comment on one thing. I think the one thing that has been demonstrated through the broadband program is that there's a desire to provide the service to every household in Minnesota. But as I look at this bill and I see a decreasing percentage of money that's available to those for grants available to those businesses and projects that don't comply with the requirements of this bill, what you're doing is you are once again shortchanging Greater Minnesota. I made the statement last week about the fact that in the case of the issue of prevailing wage, that does not work in Greater Minnesota. And it has been well established, and it was stated by one of the testifiers, the fact that you have in the rural areas, you have a greater cost per customer to produce the service to them simply because of distance, and as you reduce that, you will further reduce the availability of those providers of the installation services in our area, and you will make it virtually impossible to achieve the goals that have been set forward in the broadband legislation. And so I find that particularly troublesome for my district, for your districts like yours, Senator France, for anyone that represents greater Minnesota. And I think, you know, I hate to use a phrase that's overused most of the time, but this bill is not ready for prime time. There are too many problems that it's going to create in the awarding of grants and the development of these systems throughout the entire state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Weber. We're going to Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator McEwen, for bringing a bill about prevailing wages, I have to say. And I guess I have some questions, Mr. Chair. We're looking at equity discussion within the parameters of this construct, and there's some ambiguity that I'm not okay with. Words like other groups or currently underrepresented, and it's been in my tenure here that unless you call out, for example, I'm going to use people with disabilities are twice as likely to be unemployed than anybody else, no matter where the labor market sits, high, low, it doesn't matter. It's twice as likely to be unemployed, period. That's just, it is a given. Yet, we know the National Institutes of Health just recently said when it comes to healthcare disparities, people with disabilities. They're starting to recognize the fact that that happens. Plus, there's also an intersectional conversation that occurs too. You cannot have one conversation about poverty without realizing that poverty and disability go hand in hand. You cannot have one conversation about homelessness without realizing you have to talk about intellectual disability, developmental disability, mental health, substance use. That all goes hand in hand, right? But when you see this thing in here that you just call out the four groups and then you use this ambiguous term other groups, unless it's delineated in there about what you're trying to do, whoever is putting this project together from the bureaucratic viewpoint isn't going to have that in mindset. So when somebody's applying, they're not going to say, oh, this is a priority for me. It's a priority to me just because of what I just laid out there. The Cato Institute will tell you that stuff, right? Not that I go around quoting the Cato Institute, but there's some other stuff I could quote. Federally, the Maternal Child Health Bureau played into the part that 30% of all HRSA-related projects within states must, 30% of it must be to children and youth with special health care needs. Guess what? That's a gimme. Anytime a state applies for the federal dollars, that's a gimme anytime a local is doing it because that's just the pattern of procedural that was put in place. So that's never a question. Yet anytime we see new initiatives come in or we're going to expand and we're using the term equity, I really get kind of sidetracked when I say, well, we just cannot have one conversation here. And so I would hope you're listening to this, Senator, because I'd like to see that kind of delineation laid out like we do within the Department of Human Services work and the Department of Health work, right? And I know it is knowing LIUNA and the folks that we do, we want equity, we want people working, we want people being paid a prevailing wage plus, right? So do I. And so I would wonder, as you're laying this over, Mr. Chair, if there's a way that work could be done prior to that, because I will not support this bill going out without having that conversation in here right now. So, however, if I get a commitment from the author that she will work on the language, this happened the other day in a committee hearing too. It's like, well, we have this, we want to get it. But if a bill's to be ready to be moving on, it should be totally ready to be moving on, right? So that's just, it goes back to you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Senator Hoffman. First of all, any other members who want to question author or any of the testifiers? Seeing none, to your point, Senator Hoffman, I have been asked many times since I started chairing this committee, can we just move it out of committee? We'll work on it. We'll get it ready. I think the better practice is to have it fixed and do the work of that committee before you move it to the next committee. So I'm in agreement with Senator Hoffman on this. I did promise Senator McEwen that we would hear all the testimony and also the member questions and then put it back to her. Senator McEwen, I know your hope is to meet deadline here. If we were to lay it over, that would allow us to bring it back on Wednesday. If, to Senator Hoffman's point, those things have been successfully addressed, maybe this committee would be willing to move it forward. I also will support your motion to send it to the Agriculture Committee, although I couldn't tell you for sure whether the other members of this committee would want to do that. And I did intend to give you the last word on that question. Long story short, Senator McEwen, if you ask us to send it to agriculture, we'll put that to a vote. If you are comfortable laying it over and giving it another 48 hours, I think the safe bet is that the majority of this committee would appreciate and respect that choice. Senator McEwen.
Thank you very much, Chair Friends, and thank you very much, members, for the excellent discussion and for sharing concerns and thoughts. You do have my commitment, absolutely, Senator Hoffman, and some of the other concerns and thoughts that were brought up to be inclusive and to listen to concerns and to make any changes where we think that that would be a good idea to create more peace in the Valley and more collaboration. I am very eager to see this bill move forward because I think it's a very important piece of legislation. That said, I do think that the 48 hours of doing some hard work on this over the next couple of days could be very fruitful because there is so much at stake here in wanting to get this huge broadband build out done right and a lot of good collaboration to be had, I believe. So, Mr. Chair, I'm absolutely fine with holding it for 48 hours in the hope we can bring it back up.
Thank you, Senator McEwen. First of all, I appreciate that. I think the committee's tried to be bipartisan. We've tried to listen to things and we've tried to work on it. And you have our pledge as a committee that on Wednesday you'll be first up and that we'll talk about the progress that you made, Mr. Prentiss, Mr. Christensen. I hope this is a hint from the committee that these members here are expecting to see some progress or it's probably not going to make it out of this committee. With that, Senator McEwen, appreciate your effort very much. And Senate file 4742 is laid over. Members, our final bill is Senator Lucero's bill. Senate file 43-73. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lucero, very good to see you. Thank you for your patience. You're here to present Senate file 4373, and you have the floor, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I woke up this morning with a tickle and a cough, so I apologize in advance for me trying to hold back this cough, and I'm not shaking any hands. I do have Fisherman's Friend with me, so hopefully this will suppress that for this. You've already moved 4373. Is the motion, are we moving it on or are you laying it over?
I have not moved anything yet, Senator.
Okay, well, I will move the bill then.
Senator Lucero moves Senate file 4373. Our intention is to lay this over. Senator, to your bill. And I understand you have an oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had enough time to formalize that into an actual amendment, which is the A1.
Senator Lucero offers the A1 amendment to the... To the amendment, Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this A1 does, real quick, if you turn to line 2.1 of the bill, in the it reads, the opt-in is optional and the person's service is not affected. And what this does is insert the word or cost of service. So the intention will be the person's service or cost of service is not affected.
Members, any questions for Senator Lucero on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The A1 is adopted. Senator Lucero, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my entire time in the legislature, I have been advocating for pro-consumer choice, pro-consumer empowerment. And that's the philosophy that underlies this bill. We are familiar with electric meters, and we may be familiar with smart meters. This bill is seeking to change an existing program that is an opt-out to requiring an opt-in. It would also then make a change in terms of the cost, and I will explain that as well. This bill is modeled after New Hampshire. There's a New Hampshire verbiage statute that allows or requires an affirmative opt-in. And again, so those who I've had the honor of serving with, you'll know that the affirmative opt-in is something that I have been advocating for across the board in many different policy areas. Because in my experience in cybersecurity, I've seen it all too often where there is an assumed consent, and then it's the burden of the person to opt themselves out of whatever that is. So I'm carrying forward that philosophy that it should be assumed that there's not authorization, and the entity would be required to gain that affirmative consent. I will read here a synopsis of some of the privacy and security concerns that a smart meter brings with it when it is installed on a person's home, because what a smart meter allows for is the individual monitoring of appliances within a home and the individual consumption rate of those appliances. So very briefly, the privacy concerns associated with smart energy meters primarily stem from collecting and storing personal energy consumption data. This data can provide detailed insight into a household's daily routine, habits, lifestyle, which could be used by third parties for various purposes such as targeting, marketing, or even criminal activities like burglary. Moreover, there are concerns about the unauthorized sharing or selling of this data to third parties, including energy suppliers, marketers, and government agencies, which can raise issues about misuse of personal data and the erosion of privacy rights. And some of the security concerns include internet-connected, which is the nature of these meters, and can be accessed remotely. It is their vulnerability to hacking and cyber attacks. If an attacker gains access to a smart meter, they could tamper with the meter's readings or disrupt the energy flow in the grid. And it goes on. We know, and I hope we agree, that again, people should be empowered with a choice. I do not want anybody who wants to make any decision in regards to their family, their household, their meter, any technology that's adopted, I don't want to strip that or take that away. I just want people to have to be required to be give their affirmative consent. This has the smart meter allows for variable pricing, which is something that I have seen in several of the documents from the energy providers in Minnesota. I'm very concerned about variable pricing. I believe in the current one rate, regardless of time of day. And then lastly, what the amendment did, and why I'll touch on that, is I am a strong believer in incentivizing people's behavior by saving, not penalizing them for not participating in a program. And the current program, for example, that was approved by the PUC, it penalizes people by charging them $15 a month rather than incentivizing, which would be something I would be promoting, something to incentivize a change in people's behavior. So with that background, Mr. Chair, it's my understanding there is one testifier.
There is, Senator Lucero. I believe your testifier is online, and if I'm not mistaken, we show Isaac Orr. Mr. Orr, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
If you could please introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Isaac Orr, and I'm a policy fellow specializing in energy and environmental policy at Center of the American Experiment. I'd like to thank Senator Lucero for inviting me to testify today on Senate File 4373. Which would require electric utilities to obtain written consent before installing smart meter gateway devices on Minnesota homes and businesses. I've received dozens of calls and emails from our readers and supporters who are concerned about Xcel Energy's smart meter rollout. It is easily the issue that the most people contact me about. And one of the things I'd like to address is Xcel claims that very few people opt out of its smart meter program. But this is likely because of that additional charge that it's leveling on captive ratepayers. I know that's why I allowed them to put one on my property. So many of our supporters are senior citizens, and they feel like the additional $15 fee for opting out is punitive and designed to coerce them into signing up for the program. And this is especially problematic because they're already struggling to keep up with the large rate increases that Xcel has enacted in the last few years. In the view of the people who contact me, coercion is not consent on this regard. They're also concerned about time of use rates and the possibility that these devices will be used to ration electricity consumption during periods of high demand and low wind and solar output in the future. Time of use rates are already being used in California, causing rates for some customers to jump from 30 cents per kilowatt hour to 50 cents per kilowatt hour. And these are all California prices, so obviously keep that in mind. But 50 cents per kilowatt hour is 3.5 times higher than the current Minnesota residential average rate in Minnesota. So this bill would ensure that people who wish to have a smart meter and participate in time of use rate programs or AC rewards have the option to do so while preventing utilities from coercing residents into a smart meter that they would prefer not to have. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. Any members of the public who were not listed as testifiers that would like to come forward and testify on Senator Lucero's bill? Seeing none, members, our intention is to lay this bill over, but next we'll go to member questions. Senator Grunhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, thanks for bringing the bill. No, my daughter lives in the Seven County metro area, and they just showed up and put it right on her house and charged her the extra $15. And she called me up and said, Dad, how can they do that? So I would strongly support this bill because I do believe in consumer choice. And once she understood it, it probably was a little bit better. I did talk to a lobbyist from Xcel about it. But I do still believe in private property and the choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Grunhagen. We have Senator Hoffman. Then we'll go to Senator McEwen. Senator Hoffman.
I was just going to ask, Mr. Chair, if Senator Grunhagen, was that your daughter that worked for my nephew at one time? Is that was the...
Senator Grunhagen.
Is that within the rules to respond to that question?
It is in this committee.
Glencoe Grocery Store. That's funny.
Yeah, I think it is.
That's funny. I love it. So I just wanted to... It was a good... I like that. That's what... I was trying to make it light and, you know, whatever. I'll stop.
Thank Appreciate
you.
The Hoffman. Question.
Thank you, Senator Grunhagen. Senator McEwen.
Thanks for bringing this bill. This is really interesting. I'm wondering if you can just tell us briefly a little bit more about these, is it smart meters? Because this is the first I've heard of them, and I'm wondering, so in the bill it reads that it would be a connection directly, basically like into the home of appliances or like use of electricity of certain appliances. I just want to get more to like the heart of the concern with these. If you could tell us a little bit more information. It sounds like it's more than the privacy concern goes further than just, you know, you're weighing like efficiency, like gains in efficiency versus privacy. And I'm just wondering how that shakes out.
Thank you, Senator McEwen. Senator Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator McEwen. The primary concern for me is first and foremost choice, allowing consumers to be empowered to make whatever choice that they believe to be best for themselves and their family and their household. The second is the pricing, as we've heard. Smart meters are strongly associated with variable pricing or dynamic pricing, and that's something I do not agree with. Third would be the privacy. Smart meters are, it's not just a one-way communication, which I have no opposition to having a meter that is reading and sends information one way for the purposes of just capturing the usage. But when it gets smart meters now, is getting much more granular and allows for individual appliances within the home to begin to be monitored. And that data is then sent. And as I read one of the articles here on some of the privacy concerns, the invasiveness that gives to wherever that data might be shared with third parties, et cetera. And one of the things that as I was preparing for this, I actually thought back, I should have looked it up, but I don't recall now. There was a Supreme Court case. This was probably two decades ago, and it was in a totally different context, but it was law enforcement on the road going down with, the technology, infrared, that allows for heat to be detected within a home, and the Supreme Court struck that down, and their reasoning was a place of abode is the sanctuary. It's a protected space, and government can't peer in there. This gets dangerously close. While Xcel Energy is certainly not the government, it's borderline peering into somebody's home. and having data extracted and then sent and shared with others. So those are the primary concerns, including the individual appliance usage.
Thank you, Senator Lucero. Any follow-up, Senator McEwen?
Thank you. I appreciate that very much, Senator Lucero. And it does beg the question for me that now in our day and age with internet use, just how much of our personal data is known and being out there and is being sold and traded without our permission or with our sign-off that wasn't really well-informed, not a meaningful sign-off. So thanks for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Senator McEwen. Senator Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Lucero. So my understanding of the smart meters is, because it's starting to sound like it's monitoring everything, is that part of it is just instead of having someone go to your house and check your meter, that meter is being communicated back, and so that visit is not required. And the reason is it's two ways, is particular in case of an outage or something else, that they're able to, the utility company is actually able to send you information about when your outage might be resolved and things of that. So I don't think it's, my understanding is it's not personally saying this much is your refrigerator, this much is this, it's just, it's monitoring it over the course of the day. And so it's a little easy to tell, like, the air conditioning at the peak hours is probably air conditioning, but it's not specifically reading those different things. But my understanding is that the $15 in part is because they're not having to actually go to your house now and do all of that. So to me, if they're now having, if someone has opted out and that requires someone, them to employ extra staff to start reading all the meters again, wouldn't that also be a cost to the consumer at the end versus, I mean, so one way or the other, the $15 is going to be charged to the consumers because they're going to have to read these meters. So I don't necessarily see it as a savings because it's probably just going to get rolled back in your bill.
Thank you, Senator Mitchell. A great question, including the issue of ratepayer recovery. Senator Lucero, any response?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first, the issue of the individual monitoring or granularity of the appliances. So here's an Xcel Energy is one of their printouts. And in here it says, all residential and small commercial consumers in Minnesota will receive a new meter that will either be a smart meter or non-communicated meter. And then in among, I won't read the whole thing, but then it says, you will, so if you don't have it, don't have a smart meter, you will also not be able to see a breakdown of energy consumption by appliance. So it does get into that granularity. And so again, when it comes to that breakdown and the harvesting of that information and then being sent to these other entities, you lose control, and for many, they have a privacy concern. That's not in the packet, but this is in the packet. This one is from Minnesota Power, and in here at the very bottom, they say gateways, and then they're referring to interactive options with consumers. Again, I don't have a problem with that, but it needs to be, in my opinion, an affirmative opt-in. Let's see, what was the other? I should have wrote down your question. Shame on me.
Is it a savings?
A savings. There we go. That's a very fair point. In my opinion, and this is just probably a difference in philosophy, I believe there should be the baseline for what the cost is for the standard. And then to incentivize somebody with a savings if they wanted to choose to have a smart meter. But the way that it is currently set is the new baseline is set at the smart meter, and then it becomes a penalty to retain the old if a person chooses to not have a smart meter. So again, it's a different philosophical approach. Having an incentive, fair game, to choose to do that versus having a penalty for choosing not to do XYZ. Then the other option I wanted to, or just quickly to follow up to Senator McEwen, Mr. Chair, was one of the things that I have greatly appreciated bipartisanly in my decade here at the legislature is the topic of data harvesting, data information, personal privacy, and I've worked with many on both sides of the aisle in terms of student data privacy and the harvesting of information, in the technology, in the use of law enforcement, and the harvesting of information, and where they might be sent to. All kinds of different applications. I look at this as just another one of those applications of harvesting information that some, not all, but those who have a privacy concern would be empowered to make that choice without being penalized for it.
Thanks, Senator Lucero. Any follow-up, Senator Mitchell? All right, members, any further questions for Senator Lucero? Any closing comments before we lay the bill over, Senator?
I appreciate the time for this, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this, and I look forward to continuing to work to empower consumers across Minnesota and to protect their privacy.
Thank you. With that, Senator Lucero's bill 4373 is laid over. That concludes the agenda. Members, on Wednesday, please keep in mind that PUC Commissioner Kwaikwan Han, who was recommended to be confirmed by this committee, is expected to have his confirmation on the Senate floor. We'll also be hearing from Senator McEwen back, we hope, with the bill that we just heard, Senator Rarick, Senate File 4562, Senator McEwen again with the Utility Thermal Network Deployment Work Group, Senator McEwen again with state agency issued permits. We'll be back with the permitting bill on Wednesday to finally send that thing off. Senator Mitchell with the pilot thermal energy network projects, and Senator Klein with the Dakota County Energy Efficient Projects Appropriation. With that, members, great session. We are adjourned.